The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third row seating, available dual wireless charging pads. You've got the H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on those dirt trails and kick up some mud. Or the third row seating gets your whole family in to experience the thrill together. The dual wireless charging pads make sure that no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead cell phone. Think about those adventurous activities you can do, like me, taking a ski trip up with the family, maybe going on a camping expedition, anything and everything. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
Hey there, it's Gary Parrish. It's Thursday, June 30th, 2022. Welcome back to the CBS Sports Eye on College Basketball Podcast, where we sometimes discuss camel fighting, dodo birds, and leaky black cow. Boone is here with me. If you're watching live on YouTube, please smash the like button like you're Brandon Davies. You have consent. The big news of the week, I guess, is that Amani Bates has found home. He's going to be an Eastern Michigan Eagle. He's going home to Ypsilanti to play for Stan Heath, largely because his options really dwindled to nearly nothing in recent weeks. Michigan didn't want him. Michigan State didn't want him. Louisville didn't want him. Reportedly, Amani Bates wanted to go at one point at the last minute, but Hardaway also did not want him. As I wrote in a column that you can find at CBSSports.com, it is a striking fall from prominence. Less than 3 years ago, at the age of 15, Amani Bates was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. The words next to his face were, "Built for this." Underneath his chin, and it's not a strong jaw like strong jaw, but, you know, he has a chin. It read Michael, Magic, Ron, and it was written by Michael Rosenberg. A college assistant called Imani Bates, headed to Eastern Michigan, where he needs a strong bounce back season after one disastrous year at Memphis to maybe compete for MAC Player of the Year's honors. So that's where we're at. Kyle Boone, what do you make of this Amani Bates situation? How you go from being labeled the number one player in your class in 2022, then reclassifying to 2021, where you're still a top five prospect with the guy who went first in the 2021 NBA draft, second in the 2021 NBA draft, and seventh in the 2021 NBA draft. And now you're basically being told by one high major after another, we don't want you. You should probably just go to Eastern Michigan.
Yeah, it's kind of a long path that Amani has taken to get to this point, going all the way from tracking to high school. You know, he was pulled out of high school to play, you know, prep school on a team that was built around him. And I think ideally, right, I think the premise of that decision was, hey, the talent around you is not going to be super great, but you're going to be the feature spot. You're going to be the reason guys come to scout you. When they come to watch your games, they're going to only watch you. The talent surrounding him was not ideal. I think that ended up hurting him. Kevin Flaherty, who writes for 247, had noted to me yesterday, I think the decision to not play up was maybe questioned in grassroots circles, because, as you mentioned at the top, this is a guy who has been for years and years and years considered the number one talent, not just like at his classification, but like basically the best basketball prospect, regardless of age. And he continued to play basically at his level. He mostly played down. The talent around him was not ideal. And then he goes and reclassifies, plays at Memphis. Counting stats were okay, but He didn't look like, you know, the guy that I think people expected him maybe to be, as, you know, a five-star recruit, former number one recruit in his class, and was running through the numbers with Amani Bates and Memphis, and adjusted team offensive efficiency with Amani last season. This is per Evan Maya, who runs a great analytics website. It's 109.9. That ranked seventh on Memphis's team last season. Adjusted team defensive efficiency with Amani, again, this is per Evan Maya, 89.1. That ranked eighth on the team. And This is crazy. I don't know if you know this or not. You can actually sort Bart Torvik data using different dates. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, crazy, crazy thing. I just realized this. So I'd like to trademark this as something new and profound. Memphis with Imani last season. This was in games November 9th through January 27th. 66th at Bart Torvik. Memphis when Imani was out with, you know, basically a back injury. I think it was the reasoning that he was out. Games played February 5th through March 13th, which is basically the end of the AAC tournament. Memphis ranked number 6th at Bart Torvik. So I think the overwhelming data suggests that Memphis was a better team when Imani Bates was not playing. And I think you can maybe say he's in over his head. He wasn't developmentally quite ready to contribute at a high level to a really good Memphis team that was clearly older. You know, outside of Jalen Duren, that was a pretty experienced college basketball team. But I think it's an indictment overall of kind of where his game is at now. Clearly, the options that he had when he hit the transfer portal, I think people expected he would land at a high major situation because teams typically want to bet on 5-star recruits who have that type of pedigree. But that was not the case. Sounds like the reports are that most of the high major programs' interest kind of dried up. And now he lands with EMU. Going back to his home state, I think it could be a good situation for him, but this is a guy who has to kind of rebuild himself, his confidence and his game. I still believe that he has NBA potential, but he's a long ways off from being kind of the prodigious talent that I think a lot of people expected he was.
Yeah, this is a story that still has to write an ending. The idea that it's over for Imani Bates is crazy. You know, I just wrote like 1,200 words about him, and nowhere in there do I insist the Imani Bates as an NBA player storyline is dead. He can still get to where he always seemed destined to go. Although I do think it's reasonable to, at this point, assume he'll never be Magic, Michael, or LeBron, or anything like that. A lot of thoughts here, so bear with me. When I tweeted the link to the column this morning. One of the comments in there was, nothing's wrong with Imani Bates. The real thing that's wrong is a media member identified him improperly 3 years ago and called him something he was never going to be. So a media member misevaluated him. That's the only wrong thing with Imani Bates. And to that, I would just say, that's 100% wrong. That is not what happened. Michael Rosenberg didn't decide just all willy-nilly. I think this 15-year-old is the next Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Magic Johnson. That was widely regarded as Imani Bates' reputation at the time. This isn't something where a guy at Sports Illustrated decided to write a story and everybody was like, this is crazy. Like, if you just fundamentally think it's crazy to label 15-year-olds that way, I hear you. And maybe this will be a lesson for why we should never do it. Like, no matter what a 15-year-old looks like, we don't take it that far yet because remember Imani Bates? Perhaps that will be the larger lesson from this. But at the time, there was nothing crazy about talking about Imani Bates that way. There were tons of talent evaluators who said, this is the best 15-year-old I've ever seen. You know, in the story, a coach is quoted as saying, he's the best player I've ever seen. And another coach was like, yeah, I agree. You know, he looked the part, you know, he looked the part. And then it just stopped. Like, you're supposed to go from being the best 15-year-old in the world to being an even better version of yourself at 16 and an even better version of yourself at 17. But a variety of things, I think, contributed to his development just pausing. Some of it was the pandemic. You know, he lost a year in there, but everybody lost a year in there. And it didn't seem to hurt Chet Holmgren or Paolo Banchero or Shaedon Sharpe or any of these other guys who were similarly talked about, you know, at comparable ages, or at least, you know, before they entered college. So that's an explanation on some level, but you know, all of us endure the pandemic, and it didn't pause all basketball players' development. I think the larger thing is what you noted. They pulled him out of his high school. They built the prep school around them. And not only did they do that, they built a grassroots team around them. And I guess on some level, the explanation for that could be what you noted, which is, hey, you won't be around comparable talent, but like it'll be all about you. I maybe that played a role. I think it was probably profitable as well. I'm assuming that it was a profitable. These decisions were profitable. I'm assuming that. I don't know that, but I'm assuming it. I've always assumed it. And when you did that, and by you, I mean Elgin Bates, Amani Bates' father, what you did is, it seems clear with the benefit of hindsight, is really create situations all year round, throughout the high school season, then into the summer season, that you created situations where he's not being pushed by comparable talent. He's not being coached by high-level people. And I don't care how talented you are, if you don't know how to push yourself and or you're not being pushed by other people, you start to flatten a little bit. And rather than and by the way, this was clear. This was clear. Like when we all, got back to living relatively normal lives. And for these purposes, I mean, going back to Peach Jam and watching high school prospects. I remember going to Peach Jam, I guess it was last summer. And the prevailing thought among coaches were like, man, Amani Bates is not good. I remember seeing a Pac-12 coach. I was walking into the gym. He was walking out. It was one of those things. You know how it is. Hey, what's up? And I said, who you been watching? And he was like, I was in this gym. He goes, and this, I swear to God, this is exactly what he said next. Dude, Amani Bates sucks. And I was like, what? Now, I don't think he meant Amani Bates sucks, right? But he just meant like, that's not, remember what he was?
Yeah.
It don't look like that anymore. And it just, rather than recognize this, as name, image, and likeness rights were becoming a reality for college athletes, his father fast-tracked it, presumably to cash in real time, and reclassified and sent a 17-year-old, very thin young man to play at Memphis, even though it became clear almost the moment he got on campus that he wasn't ready for that. And still Penny Hardaway was trying to force it a little bit because, like, it's Amani Bates, five-star freshman, projected lottery pick. We got to start him, got to play him, got to run things through him. But it became clear quickly they're better without him. They went through a four-game losing streak to Iowa State, Georgia, Ole Miss, Murray State. And there was a three-game stretch where Amani against Ole Miss, Murray State, Alabama went 5 of 23 from the field in that stretch. And then he basically got benched in the second half of the Alabama game. Like, started the half, I don't remember the exact details, but like played 4 minutes, Penny took him out, and he never came back in the game. And they won the game. And this was a win over an Alabama team that I think had just beaten Gonzaga. And after that, his role didn't diminish like greatly. Like, he still played, but he wasn't nearly as important to the process, to what was happening, as he was supposed to be when the season started. Yep. And then he gets this back injury. And this is interesting because you're right. That is what they called it. And if you read stories, written over the past 24 hours, it's like missed 18 games with a back injury. Leading up to the back injury, and for people not watching it live on YouTube, I'm using air quotes with back injury. Leading up to that, he was playing somewhere between 20 and 27 minutes per game. Literally nobody ever mentioned a back issue at all. How's Amani feeling? Oh, he's fine. Any issue? No, no issue. Nobody ever mentioned this. And then he had a back issue. He's not playing anymore, and he's back in Michigan. First off, Memphis has doctors. Yeah. You don't have to go to Michigan to go to the doctor. You know, when a player from Michigan goes to Kentucky and encounters some sort of medical issue, they just see the doctors in Kentucky. They don't say, I got to go home to Michigan. I'll see you guys when I see you guys. It was unusual, weird. Mm-hmm. And I'm not insisting that he didn't have that his back didn't hurt. Like, everybody's back hurts. My back's hurting right now.
Same.
But I do not believe he missed more than a month of basketball with a back issue. I never believed it then. I don't believe it now. I believe more likely that his father was frustrated with how things were going, and they were on the verge of shutting it down for good. Now, Imani did come back and, you know, play maybe 3 minutes against Boise State in the NCAA tournament, 12 more against Gonzaga, but he was never a part of the team anymore. And I think that had to do more with his father than his back. And the father is among the reasons none of these schools wanted him this summer. I should say, being a father is difficult. And I'm sure Elgin Bates loves his son and has been trying to do the right things by his son. Being a parent is complicated. And I imagine, can't say for sure because this doesn't apply to me, but I imagine being the parent of the next big thing and you got a million different things pulling you in different directions, I imagine that gets super complicated. So those are my disclaimers. But it is hard to refute the idea that he has mismanaged this at every turn since Imani Bates was labeled the best 15-year-old in the world. The prep school was a mistake. Building the grassroots team around him was a mistake. I think fast-tracking him to Memphis certainly looks like a mistake. And the way he handled the whole situation when Imani was at Memphis, also a mistake. Causing scenes inside FedEx Forum at home games, literally yelling at the coaching staff in the middle of games. Like other high major coaches, Juwan Howard, Kenny Payne, Tom Izzo, like they watched this or heard about it and were like, I'm not getting involved in this. Like once upon a time, you were willing to deal with Elgin Bates because Imani Bates was this generational talent. Now he doesn't look like he's a generational talent. And that's how you end up having your options dwindled. And now you're playing at Eastern Michigan. And it might go well. I hope it does. But it strikes me, and I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this, it strikes me as falling under the umbrella, same umbrella of what they've done every step of the way. Imani is going to have this whole program back home built around him where he's going to get all the shots. And how is that going to be good for him? It hasn't been good for him in high school, at the prep school, on a grassroots level. I thought if he could get in with G League Ignite, be around pros and off the radar, that would have been beneficial. Or go somewhere where you can have a strong coach, you're surrounded by comparable talent, and the coach has the power to say, Elgin, don't call me. Don't move here. Detach from your son and let me coach him. Now, maybe that option at the high major level just did not exist, but this Eastern Michigan thing doesn't sound like it's the type of thing that rejuvenates his career in a way that puts him back, you know, in projected lotteries for the 2023 NBA draft.
Yeah. And I think that's a very fair criticism. I would also add too, this is definitely partly just a talent problem. Take another prospect, for example, who had just a wild high school prospect trajectory, LaMelo Ball. His dad pulled him out of high school as a junior. He played overseas with Lithuania. Widely considered to be just a very strange decision because he was at Chino Hills. He was really developing. Like I think at the time was a 5-star recruit. He was considered to be like one of the top prospects at the high school level in his class. Goes to Lithuania. Isn't there very long. He signs up with the Los Angeles Ballers in the JBA, a professional league that was created by LaVar Ball. And still yet, he continues on. He goes to the Illawarra Hawks, plays in the NBL. And there it's where he kind of really establishes himself as one of the bright young stars in college basketball. It was a strange path. People were questioning LaVar Ball at every turn. And I think rightfully so, because it was a jarring path. It was not a path that typical blue chip prospects take. But I think in the end, LaMelo Ball's talent won out. His development won out. I don't know. Are we giving credit to LaVar Ball now for that? I still don't know.
I've always, and I don't want to get too off track here, but I've always thought the criticism of LaVar Ball, like LaVar Ball is the worst dad ever. Like LaVar Ball raised three young men who were given who could have had athletic scholarships to play, to go to college for free. And two of them were top three picks in the NBA draft. Yeah. Did LaVar Ball make mistakes along the way? Sure. Did he behave in a way that I don't think I would have behaved? Of course. But largely speaking, when I look at LaVar Ball, what I always saw from the first day I met him, and I met him before anybody knew who he was, what I saw was a super involved father who loves his boys and spends every minute of free time trying to turn them into something he wanted them to be. And like, you know, that's way closer to dad of the year than worst father ever from my perspective.
Yeah, I agree. I'm certainly not criticizing LaVar. Although at the time, I think there was a lot of questions about what is LaVar doing? He's ruining LaMelo. Because it looked like the path was there for him to just be kind of take the traditional route, go through the high school ranks, be a five-star recruit, go to UCLA where he was originally committed, go on and be a top pick. And he turned himself into the number three pick just a few years ago.
And on that, I guess I would argue those are things I think LaVar probably mismanaged. I think a lot of that stuff was done incorrectly. But to your point, I think this is the point you're making. LaMelo was so talented. He just got there anyway. He was so talented. He just got there anyway. And it is possible, if not probable at this point, that Amani Bates just does not possess that same type of natural talent.
Yeah, that's exactly the point I'm making. It sounds like Elgin Bates has kind of fumbled the bag in several ways here. And maybe he hasn't literally fumbled the bag. Maybe he's got the bag multiple times, but he's fumbled the situation to the point where he hasn't, I don't think, put Imani in the best situations. Now, I think Imani's development has really been hurt over the last few years, in part because of some of the decisions that he's made. And he has not quite developed in the same way, same trajectory, same, you know, path to being a potential first-round pick that LaMelo took. I think that's probably more testament to LaMelo and his talent than it is to Imani and the situation that he's faced. But I think it's fair to blame Elgin to some extent, but also just Imani over the last few years had really plateaued, was kind of riding high off the reputation. And, the fact that he won and done at Memphis and, you know, basically was not welcomed back, I think is not a surprise. I do want to ask you, GP, I want to play a little game if you're open to it.
I'm open to games, sure.
Okay. This is called the Kevin Durant or Imani Bates game.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up some scouting reports from high school, and I want you to tell me who wrote what the description is for each scouting report and who it is being named. So we'll go. This is the first one here. I'll give you an easy one. This is the first game I watched him as a 10th grader. He is turning into a man, all caps, man. Best prospect since LeBron, and it ain't even close.
I would say that was about Kevin Durant.
That was about Imani Bates.
Ugh.
Okay, next one. Player X has already shown he can be consistently effective against the best players in this class using his versatility to contribute in other ways when his shot isn't falling. But it's unseen how his game will translate to college and eventually to the NBA. If he doesn't add some more bulk to his currently wirely frame, he would be best served to increase his strength heading into next year while developing some reliable back-to-the-basket moves as well.
That sounds like Kevin Durant.
That is Kevin Durant. Okay. That is right. Next one, the best NBA prospect in the world, regardless of age, he's arguably the best NBA prospect I've ever evaluated. 6'9", handles it like a guard, can pull up anywhere on the floor, has a star quality about him, a killer instinct. The kid has all the makings of a future number one pick, a franchise-changing talent.
That sounds like it's about Imani Bates.
That is about Imani Bates. I have several others here.
That's the point I was trying to make earlier. Like the idea that I'm sure Michael Rosenberg like hates the attention that that cover story now gets, but he wasn't out of line. He was in pretty in lockstep with the general. Again, this wasn't a Michael Rosenberg evaluation. He was talking to college basketball coaches and NBA front office executives. This was largely what people thought Imani Bates was, the next big thing, the best NBA prospect in the world, regardless of age. And keep in mind, less than a year ago, he was ranked number one in the class of 2022. That was less than a year ago. And when we got reclassified, he, at 24/7 Sports, was slotted fifth behind only Chet Holmgren, Paolo Banchero, Shaedon Sharpe, and Jaden Hardy, guys that were picked first, second, seventh, and somewhere in the 30s of last week's NBA draft. But I think not the first sign that there might be issues, but a sign that there would be issues was the Memphis Pro Day last year. I don't know if you remember this. He was terrible. I mean, not in terms of basketball stuff. I don't know. I didn't see that. But the measurements were bad. He has no wingspan. Mm-hmm. It was like, 6'9 with a 6'9 wingspan, which is not good. And I'm not even sure it was 6'9. Whatever it was, his arms were notably not what you would want them to be.
T-Rex arms. Yeah.
He has T-Rex arms. And then the vertical was like 24 or 26. It was something that it was like he tested like a non-athlete and measured in a way you don't want wings to measure. And I think that really opened some eyes. And then when you combine that with the basketball stuff looked inefficient and overwhelming for him at Memphis, you get to a place where it is not guaranteed that he'll be picked in the 2023 NBA draft. I think most people right now have him projected as a borderline first round pick. Where would you have him right now in next year's draft?
At this point, I would not have him as a first round pick. I think it's one of those things I want to see it happen. I want to see him progress a little bit more before I have him as a first round pick. Wouldn't surprise me if he ended up as a first round pick next year. In fact, I think it's more likely than not that he ends up as a top 30 guy come next year. But like at this point, I would not be touching Imani Bates unless I see some notable improvement.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. Yeah. We got someone in the comments, Coach Hastings here on YouTube, who said, how do you guys think this would compare to Patrick Baldwin going to Milwaukee? Mm-hmm. Obviously not entirely the same situation, but he'll have to dominate the MAC in order to be a top pick, right? I think this is very different than the Patrick Baldwin situation because what NBA people looked at as it pertains to Patrick Baldwin's disastrous season at Milwaukee it was just a disastrous season at Milwaukee under not great circumstances. We don't care. We're going to believe in what we saw when he was a standout, high school prospect. Obviously, the season at Milwaukee, it mattered some because he went 28th instead of 8th. But the Golden State Warriors, at the very least, just said, we're not worried about that. We're going to evaluate him the same way the Grizzlies evaluated Zaire Williams the year before. We're not worried about the 1 year. We believe in the talent. The problem for Imani is if he has a disastrous year at Eastern Michigan, whatever that looks like, that's two disastrous years of college basketball. Yeah. And at that point, it becomes nonsensical to evaluate him on what he was at Peach Jam, years earlier. At that point, you've just watched this guy play two seasons of college basketball for different coaches, different leagues at different levels. And if, again, this is for the sake of the conversation, assuming if he's not good, then that's like, he's just not good. At that point, he's 6'9", has some skill, can make some shots, was really awesome when he was 15, but we watched him at 17 and 18 be a not good college basketball player. Then I think you're done as a draftable prospect. I still think there's a ceiling now on what he can become as a prospect. Like I don't think I could imagine him becoming a top five guy now, no matter what he does at Eastern Michigan. And it's not that you can't evaluate players at that level. Obviously you can. You know, Damian Lillard was evaluated at Weber State. Ja Morant was evaluated at Murray State. These NBA front office executives are so good that they can find you literally anywhere. So it's not that playing against MAC players won't give him the opportunity to prove that he's a legitimate NBA prospect. But I do think this is kind of the same recipe that got him here, which is, you know, he needs to not be the best guy on his team, the leading shot taker on his team. He needs to be pushed in practice, maybe get overwhelmed a little bit in practice every once in a while. That's the way I could envision him getting better. Going to Eastern Michigan and taking all the shots for a team that, you know, probably isn't going to win that much. I mean, earlier in this offseason, Amani Bates was quoted as saying the most important thing, quote, most important thing was that he wanted to win. And he just went to a program that hasn't had a winning record since 2018, hadn't made the NCAA tournament since 1998, finished outside of the top 300 at KenPom this past season, and as of last night was 262 at BartTorvik.com. Like, this is probably not going to be a winning situation. And certainly not winning to any sort of notable degree at the college level. So going to a program where he's going to take all the shots, lose a lot. I hope I'm wrong. I'd love to be wrong. Because if I'm not wrong, this is one of the sad stories of how prospects go from one place to another. But I would have done something other than this, I think. Although, like we've noted, his options seem to have dwindled to almost nothing and Eastern Michigan in recent weeks. It's a wild story. Cause I mean, you don't see this happen. I mean, I think literally ever, you know, a year after being named the number one player in your class, nobody wants you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where we're at, you know, you saw throughout this process, big names pop up. Louisville's involved and mm-hmm. Michigan's involved. And they just took other people. And it is being reported that if Penny Hardaway would have taken him back, he would have just stayed at Memphis. He would have exited the transfer portal and come back to Memphis. That is what multiple, John Martin at the Daily Memphian, Mark Giannotto at the Commercial Appeal, they have both reported that. And that Penny... And I think this shows a little bit of a changing perspective from Penny Hardaway on Penny Hardaway's part as well. Like Penny, since he became the Memphis coach, has always wanted the shiniest things. Give me all the five stars I can get. And now he was like, rather than deal with Elgin Bates another year and try to turn Amani Bates back into an NBA prospect, you know what? I'm going to take Emmanuel Acott from Boise State. I'm going to take Keontae Kennedy from UTEP. I mean, that is literally what they did. Kenny Hardaway more or less decided, I'd rather have Emmanuel Acott and Keontae Kennedy than Imani Bates. I'd rather have older guys who I know can play in college than I'd rather focus on building a good college basketball team, whatever that looks like, than having part of my job over the next year being turning Imani Bates into what Imani Bates was supposed to be. I'll let Stan Heath do that. That's like really a decision Penny Hardaway appears to have made.
Yeah. Shout out to Coach Hastings for the question on the Patrick Baldwin. I think that's a great question. And shout out to, in the chat, Jonathan Phipps, who is always a very active member, always commenting. Real quick on the Hastings, like the Baldwin comp, I don't think is even close to accurate. Baldwin, yes, they're both former number one recruits. But Baldwin had an injury, you know, early in his senior season, completely derailed his senior year, came back to Milwaukee with high expectations, obviously was a five-star, committed to Milwaukee over Duke, but never really dominated in a way that I think people expected a guy who had his pedigree, his background would. That is, you know, similar, I think, to Amani, but I still think, you know, part of Baldwin's problems was I'm not entirely sure he was healthy. He had an injury at the end of his freshman season, shut down. He really only played like basically a dozen games, kind of a mixed bag. Ended up being a first round pick. But I think most of the questions surrounding Baldwin are injury related. The questions with Imani, I think, are, you know, talent questions. How can he continue to develop? And right now he's not at the point where I think he will be a first round pick. Now, again, we talked about this earlier. I think that could change. He'll need to show some market development over the next year at Eastern Michigan, a place where I'm not entirely sure he can do that. But yeah, I think the situations are pretty different. I still do believe though that they could end up in a similar trajectory where, you know, if Imani Bates is taken, you know, 27th next year in the NBA draft, that would not surprise me at all.
And this should conclude 35-minute episodes of the Island College Basketball Podcast on Imani Bates. If we have another one of these, it means something has gone entirely, I think, more wrong than right. You know, that's the other thing about going to Eastern Michigan. It's like, I can remember at one point last season, like, Patrick Baldwin as a prospect, mm-hmm. couldn't stop talking about him, thinking about him. Patrick Baldwin makes an announcement. He's going to play for his dad. Okay, I'm going to write a column about that. And then it was like December or January, and I was like, I haven't thought about Patrick Baldwin one time. Just sort of disappeared. Now, he wasn't playing, he had injuries, but like largely just disappeared because, you know, when you go to Milwaukee, you kind of just disappear. And that's another thing that will soon happen to Imani Bates is everything he's done in basketball to this moment has been a big national headline. And I think after today, that is probably over. I think today that's probably over. Like, even if he, you know, has a nice season at Eastern Michigan and, like you said, becomes the 27th pick in the draft, it's not that notable. It's just it's just another basketball story at this point. Let's move on. Long Island University making a coaching change in late June. That's a weird timing. We'll touch on that next, but first, a word from our sponsors. Are you looking for a new basketball shoe? If so, this is Gary Parrish here to tell you that the New Balance 2-Way V4 features the groundbreaking use of fuel cell technology with fresh foam, creating the ultimate combination of rebound and cushioning. Every step feels explosive and dynamic, and the upper construction features a lightweight textile that's supportive and breathable. So whether you're hitting the clutch shot or locking down the opposition, the 2-Way V4 gives you the tools to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the 2-Way at newbalance.com.
Robert Half Research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
So Adam Finkelstein broke the news yesterday, confirmed by Long Island University earlier today. Derek Kellogg is out as LIU's coach after 5 seasons, going to be replaced by Rod Strickland, who had been running the G League Ignite program. So the timing here is obviously odd. It's late June. This is not the time you see a lot of college basketball coaches, like maybe a random retirement or off to the NBA, but just we're firing our coach who, like, literally 2 days ago was running camps at LIU. So just a wild story. What did you make of this popping seemingly out of nowhere?
Pretty stunning. Did not see this coming. Did not think that Kellogg was on the hot seat. We don't typically see firings in the summer, much less late June, early July. It is June 30th now. He was fired on June 29th. That just does not happen. He was fired 116 days after the end of their college hoop season. My opinion is it's ridiculous timing. I mean, most teams have their roster set by now. I don't think it's very fair to players who now have to decide, do they want to play for, you know, Rod Strickland, or do they want to transfer? Don't think it's fair to Kellogg, who was, you know, he was fine as LIU's coach. He was 74-74, was doing pretty well. Don't think it's fair for Strickland, who takes over now, you know, in the summer months and has to kind of pick up the pieces at LIU. Just strange timing, strange circumstances all the way around. You know, for those who maybe aren't familiar with Kellogg, he's a longtime Memphis assistant under Cal. Has been at LIU for several years now, and seemed to be kind of heading in an okay direction. It's a tough job in general. Not sure what the expectations are at LIU, but yeah, it's I mean, the timing is just super weird. And as you know, like, he was running a camp at LIU just a few days ago. Like, that is pretty cutthroat from whoever made that decision. And I'm kind of curious if there's more to this story than maybe we know.
Well, I'm sure there is. Yeah. But I've known DK forever. But you mentioned he's a longtime Memphis assistant. Like, when I was the Memphis beat writer, he was on Cal staff. You know, played for Cal at UMass, was on Cal staff at Memphis. Like, I've known Rod forever too. Like, he was on staff at Memphis as well. So, you know, I know the characters in this story. And when I talked to people yesterday, you know, my fundamental stance, my basic stance on this is, unless it is scandal related and you feel like you have no choice but to make a move now, firing a basketball coach at the collegiate level in late June is crazy. It's not good for anybody. I'd argue it's not fair because DK, he'll have a buyout, and, you know, he's made some money, and, you know, financially, I don't think he's got to worry about how he's going to pay his mortgage in 6 months, right? But assistant coaches are at that level. Yeah. Like, they're not rich, and they need jobs. And it's difficult to try to find a assistant coaching job at this point in the calendar. So unless it's scandal related, this is wrong. And I was told by multiple people I trust yesterday, it's not scandal related. I was like, you know, if you did something, and you, like, I can't defend that. And I was told by multiple people, this is not one of those scandals where they had to fire the coach now. It's not like that. And, you know, I'll take those people at their word, which means that I think this is a pretty embarrassing move by LIU. You know, if you want to fire Derek Kellogg in March, you know, I haven't thought about it enough to know whether that would be reasonable or not. But to do it in late June, if it's not scandal related, just seems like something that probably shouldn't have been done. And now you hope for the, you know, DK and the people on his staff, like, that they can land on their feet, because it's much easier to land on your feet when you know you've, you know, been pushed out in March than it is when you are blindsided by this in late June. Because by all accounts, they were blindsided by this in late June. Not only was DK running camps earlier this week, he was literally tweeting pictures of, like, him and campers. Like, he was still very publicly acting as LIU's head coach. And my understanding is, had no real idea this was on the verge of happening. It's a pretty bizarre story. Like you said, I'm sure there's more to it. There's always more to everything. But unless it was scandal related, this is pretty awful timing.
Yeah. One losing season. That was 3 years ago. A couple of exactly 500 seasons. They were 16-14 last year, two games above 500. Very bizarre. Very bizarre timing. Very bizarre decision. All the way around, just kind of a head scratcher for sure.
Let's get out of here. Shouts to Devin Downey. Shouts to Chester, South Carolina. Shouts to Hook. Shouts to Larnell. And thank you guys once again for listening. Ion College Basketball Podcast. At some stage,
some stage in the dumbest pandemic of my lifetime. If you haven't subscribed, please go subscribe anywhere you subscribe to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, nice reviews while you're there. Type some words. There's more of us than there are of them. It needs to be reflected in the comments. And if you're watching on YouTube, either live right now or later on in the day, later on in the week, please, before you exit, smash that like button. It really does help in a variety of ways. So we appreciate you, and we'll talk to you again. Have a nice holiday weekend. We'll talk to you again at some point real soon. Till then, take care.
The chilling new original docuseries on Paramount Plus.
Why did he kill his family? The answer lies across the ocean in a woman named Sylvie.
She's a can model.
Where desire leads to deception.
I ended up spending $12,000 and $15,000 a day.
It was addictive.
I can't get you out.
And obsession leads to murder.
Who did this to your family?
You can't really maintain a fantasy forever.
Control Alt Desire. Now streaming on Paramount+.